Yes, hello folks, welcome to the weekly Manchester United podcast. I'm your host as always, Phil Brown. I am on my own today. It's a Thursday podcast. Don't usually do a Thursday podcast. I will be back on Monday with my regular podcast with James. What this is, a podcast primarily in reflection to what happened last night against Copenhagen. I'm going to give my thoughts on some of the talking points and try to explain some of my views in a way that I may not do a great job of doing, but nonetheless, I'll give it a crack. I hope you're all doing well, physically and mentally, in this insane world that we live in. I hope we're all taking care of each other. We need more of that. Manchester United, last night, disappointing result, as it has been so many times this season. A lot of familiar sights that we've seen in other games showed up last night, once again, and not all down to Manchester United, some of it down to refereeing decisions. Now, I know that every football fan thinks they're on the wrong end of a refereeing decision consistently because there's an agenda against the football team. Right? That's just the nature of tribalism and confirmation bias. We all think that. You've seen a ridiculous reaction from Mikel Arteta and Arsenal about some perceived injustice perpetrated against Arsenal, which is completely absurd. What he complained about was something that went unnoticed when United did it against Brighton. And Ten Hag, who badly needed a result at the time, would have been Rasmus Højlund's first Premier League goal, and a goal at a time that was a key moment in the game, barely mentioned it. We've seen Liverpool call for replays. Which to me is absurd. Especially when you look at what Manchester United have had to deal with this season. I'm not one that usually likes to bang on about refereeing decisions, because I think that when you put defeats down to a referee, you don't look at the underlying issues. And it's fine for fans to do that, but for managers and stuff, I want them to look at the things that they can change. I don't want them to say, we lost that because of the referee. Well, maybe, but you also lost it because of lots of things that are within your control that you should be trying to fix. But last night, it wasn't a particularly defining moment, because this has been done before, but how much more evidence do the authorities need that the use of VAR in subjective decisions is not helping referees? I'm going to try to make my point here. I might do a really poor job, and I don't mean to be verbose, but let me try to explain what I mean. So technology has tremendous utility on objective decisions. Did the ball go over the line or did it not? No question about it. It has tremendous benefit there. I don't ever want to go back to a time where goal line technology isn't used, because it has undoubtedly made the game better. And there's no controversy over it. The ball doesn't go in. Nobody talks about it after the game. Nobody says, well, it was actually in. No, it was just a poor angle. I mean, when was the last time you heard a discussion or a conversation or an argument about whether the ball was in or not? I mean, that has been completely eliminated. And that is correct. Maybe even has utility for automated offside. But when it comes to everything else, I don't think it adds any material benefit. If you look at football, and this is true of almost anything in life, rules are rarely applied by the letter of the law. There's always a tolerance when you file your taxes, as long as you don't, in America anyway, egregiously exaggerate. We have a bit of error, tolerance error within reason. We'll let it slide. If you're doing 40 and 35, most cops will let it slide. There's always a bit of tolerance where there's some elasticity to the rules, where they consider lots of other variables. VAR is incapable of doing that. And football's rules are almost always subjectively applied. And I push back a bit on the idea that referees have never played football, so they're incapable of adjudicating on a football game because of the lack of football experience. Most referees have played football, maybe not to the highest level. 99.9% of people watching football won't have played to the highest level, but they'll know natural body movements. They'll know from experience of playing the game, you know, the type of things that happen within football that you have a tolerance for that should not be punished. So you have this high speed, high variance game that has an element of tolerance for human error before we start applying rules. There's a certain level of contact between players that goes unpunished. You know, spit of jostling in the box goes unpunished, should go unpunished. Because this is, you know, an agreed truth between everyone that plays it, that this is okay, right? We don't want to be punished for it, we don't want you to be punished for it, right? That is imperative for the game to flow. If you want to apply every rule by the letter of the law, you will not have a game. It'll be constantly interrupted, every time two players have contact, every time this happens, it will never, you will have no continuity. It will just be a boring game of chess. So football requires, for it to function, both a tolerance on both sides that things aren't applied by the letter of the law. So when you see VAR isolate incidents that doesn't take these variables into consideration, it's trying to break something down into a fractal that is, is something that cannot be broken down into one isolated incident because it doesn't take all the other things into consideration. Human error, right? Can't gauge that. It can't gauge intent, right? It can't gauge all the things that referees used to be able to do in a split second because of their experience, both playing the game and refereeing, and knowing what was within the tolerance levels before you punished. Now, you didn't always get it right. When referees made split-second decisions, that's the accuracy rate is probably around 70%, which is relatively high. Yes, there were some really bad decisions given. And where there is a clear and obvious error, VAR could help there. The problem with that is even clear and obvious error is subjective. What if there's a micro issue in the build-up to a goal that means it shouldn't count? Should VAR call it back? One guy one week might say no, and the other guy the following week might say yes. So you're not even going to get consistency there. So in an effort to try to bring consistency, you get more inconsistency because you cannot remove a human's opinion from the loop. And when you're making split-second decisions, your brain is multi-processing different things at the same time. You're just flying down the street in a car at 70 miles an hour and a kid runs out in the road. At that moment, your brain is processing multiple different potentials to avoid that incident, and it's happening at the speed of light. So you make an instinctive decision, right? But if you turn that into an analytical decision, then you're considering things that have nothing to do with the incident itself. So if you turn around and say, okay, there was contact in the box here. You know, it's dubious as to whether it's a penalty or not. Let's go to the screen and watch this in real time. And we're going to break this down into two or three freeze frames. Okay? And if you look at it like that, then... you could do this every minute of the game in football and constantly give free kicks, constantly give decisions because it never considers, like you said, all the other unscalable variables. If you do that, just like any human being, they're going to start considering things like, okay, who's the player? What's my relationship like with the manager? What's my relationship like with the other manager? Or, what are the crowd going to think? what's the impact on the game? How's the media going to react? Am I going to be subjected to a week of scrutiny and allegations about my integrity? And and the PGML, MOL is going to be put under enormous pressure to apologize. What's the consequences if I don't give it? By the way, you and I would do exactly the same. All human beings do that. So now you turn it into a decision that is not solely about what the right decision is on the field. Mike Dean made this clear when he talked about what he did with Anthony Taylor at the Chelsea Spurs game, being no doubt that has happened so many other times. So VAR doesn't actually help referees, because one of the things that it's done is it's removed the tolerance for error for them. So now they have every decision scrutinized to a forensic degree. And one of the reasons why we get such wild inconsistency is because of the things that I just said, is because when a referee goes to look at a VAR screen and they're taking 2, 3, 4 minutes to make a decision, it's no longer about just the decision on the field. And other human beings have different personalities, different influences, different priors, different pressures. So they may be looking at a similar incident, but they're considering completely different information. And the decision, the information that influences their decision on the field is completely different, hence why we have such wide inconsistency. If those were turned into split-second decisions, we'd see much more consistency, because all those things would not be considered. I'm not saying that they're no longer under certain influences and stuff, but it's not the same. And this is true of any human being. You know, one of the biggest problems with psychology is the replication crisis. And what that means is basically you get human beings in controlled experiment and they don't react the same. They cannot replicate the results. Take 100 people here and 100 people here doing exactly the same thing with exactly the same parameter controls, exactly the same controlled environment, and they react differently. You know, this is why Facebook and all this are constantly data mining, because they're trying to figure out the most complex thing in the universe, your brain. How do human beings think? This is very difficult. Once you introduce technology in a subjective decision, you are just creating more and more chaos. It's like taking a flat iron to water and trying to make it smooth. All you do is make it worse. So there's to me a certain abstract beauty about football holistically that you can't break down into isolated moments. And in an attempt to remove the despair from a wrong decision, they are removing the spontaneous high from football. So this, to me, has no positive benefit in football, because it's so widely misused by people who don't understand that football cannot be broken down into moments, isolated moments. And that's a really long way of saying I don't really think it has tremendous benefit. And Manchester United have been on the receiving end of some absolutely horrendous decisions. I'm not saying this happens in Europe, but I refuse to believe that a referee who's sitting there thinking, do I give this 50-50 for United, knowing that there is no consequence socially if you don't give it, right? You're not going to get berated. You're not going to have Gabby Agbonlahor spontaneously combusting. You're not going to have, Danny Mills and all these media commentaries, you never hear from when United get, dubious decisions given against them every week. But they have made a career out of trolling Manchester United fans because they have nothing else to contribute. So then they find their voice. And this is quite clearly, nonsense, because it's the clickbait, outrage generator But for the referee, you know, what are they thinking? You know, I'm just not going to give it because I can't be bothered with the aggro. We would do the same. So when you look at the number of decisions they don't get, you look at the ratio of penalties they don't get compared to everyone else, you cannot look at that and explain that away and say, well, look, this is, you know, this is just normal statistical variance. You know, you should expect that. You know, because those numbers imply something different. Because there is no, you know, if you look at the averages, United should be within a couple of percent of everyone of the other teams that have similar ratios of attack. You know, how much time you spent in the box, you should have a correlation between that and the penalties you get. Well, there is none. And, you know, people never, I mean, a lot of people are still talking about that Wolves penalty. Arsenal fans are uploading a video, still 20 years later, of Wayne Rooney, you know, diving in the box for the penalty, completely forgetting, of course, the one that Cristiano Ronaldo didn't get in that game, which has been completely erased from the narrative. I mean, any controversial decision that goes in United's favour lives on ad infinitum. And the multitude of ones that go against them barely get mentioned. I know some people want to see Ten Hag come out and say this and say that and put pressure on referees. I understand why. I remember wishing Solskjaer would do that whenever Klopp was going after them. And there's no question about that. It had an impact on the decisions that were given against United. Solskjaer actually mentioned it months later. So maybe Ten Hag should say something and defend the football club. But it's never given the same energy or the same credibility. Because for a lot of people who are my age or around about my age, Manchester United have such a very clear identity to them, where they have grown up so virulently opposed to them, so prejudiced towards them, that they'll never be fair and balanced and reasoned. You know, I can look at the Liverpool goal that should have counted against Newcastle and say it 100% should have counted. You know, that was a really bad decision. But I've watched two games against Fulham this season. Manchester City and Manchester United. Manchester City had a goal that was given where Manuel Akanji is yards offside. Flicks his leg out. Leno doesn't move until the ball passes Akanji. It is the most obvious interfering with play decision you could give. And it wasn't given. And that was an important goal for City at the time. Then United against Fulham, where Harry Maguire sort of swings a leg at the ball, doesn't have any impact on how Fulham defend, goalkeeper's position, goalkeeper's movement, and there's no way you can tell me or make a case that Akanji's should have counted but Maguire's shouldn't. And people just say, well, it's just one bad decision, but this happens a lot. And that Marcus Rashford decision last night was disgraceful. Absolutely atrocious decision. The penalty that they got dubious, but he gave United's penalty because he gave the other one. Because United's wasn't really a penalty either. The first goal, Onana has his line of sight blocked. How many times have United had decisions given against them this season for that? Now, there shouldn't be a huge variance between, because the rules are the same in the Champions League and the Premier League, but how games are refereed. The penalty at home to Copenhagen, if you look at it, when that cross comes in, the Copenhagen winger, whatever it was, can't remember, actually leans in to McTominay to get the contact. Could have been given, could not. The penalty against Manchester City goes back to what I was saying earlier. What happened with Haaland and Rodri happens a million times in a game. And that's within the tolerance of error. If that's a penalty, then so too is John Stones on Rasmus Højlund shortly after that. So you can't apply that sensitivity on an ad hoc basis. You either apply it all the time or you don't do it at all. If that's a penalty, so too is Rasmus Højlund at Arsenal. Of course it is. But they wouldn't even look at it. How did Vavro not get sent off last night for an obvious arm in the face, with intent, by the way, which was obvious? Rashford's intent was, you know, obviously did not have intent. He wasn't even looking at the player. And how is he not sent off? You know, if those decisions are given correctly last night, which were simple, we are looking at a completely different scoreline. And so now when you're a manager and you're looking at the things that can significantly impact the outcome of the game, in a finely balanced game, how VAR is used will almost have as much impact on the outcome of that game than any other metric you can prepare for. You can prepare for different tactics, for different players, for different things. But if the VAR is not used appropriately, they will determine the outcome of a game. And referees are not there to determine the outcome of the game. They're there to protect the integrity of the game. So when you're showing up to watch a game of football and referees have no consistency with how they're applying the laws and it has a serious material impact on the outcome of a game, people don't want to watch that. One of the biggest, my other love is boxing. One of the things that I detest the most about boxing, and I think every boxing fan will agree, is the judges. Because what was a clear winner to everyone else is not to the judges. And you're constantly asking yourself, what did they watch? What are they seeing? What are their influences? There's no way that Timothy Bradley beat Manny Pacquiao in the first fight. There is no way in this world that happened. And this happens a lot. So one of the biggest reasons why people stopped watching boxing was because of the judging. And there seems to be an arrogance that we're not allowed to ask questions. I don't want to see referees abused. If my 16-year-old who thought about refereeing was out refereeing a grown member that was screaming in his face, I would have an issue with that big time. Don't want to see that. But maybe the rules are completely ridiculously nuanced to an insane degree that would be hard for anyone. And I don't think referees go out with an agenda to deliberately, deliberately have bias. I just think that they're human beings subject to all the influences that you and I are every single week. I mean, we know the referees give different decisions at home than they will away because of the pressure of the crowd. So, of course, they're influenced by environmental factors. So there has to be some level of accountability. You know, we've got Dermot Gallagher on explaining one decision one week and the next decision next week and using completely different logic. And it's clear that the guy is trying to defend the official, not the decision. I understand that. But, you know, yes, players and managers make the mistakes too, but they pay for their mistakes. You know, players get dropped, players get sold, players have contracts cancelled, whatever. Managers get sacked. You know, they're held accountable for their mistakes. I mean, like I said, the mistakes that they make every week are so egregious and so ridiculous that you're wondering, what are they watching? And my only explanation is, they see the same thing you and I are seeing, but they're not thinking the same thing you and I are thinking because they're under completely different pressures to call something a certain way. That's the only explanation I can come up with for why we have such wild inconsistency and such obvious decisions. So Ten Hag was unlucky last night, as he has been numerous times this season, where decisions have not gone his way, where if they had gone his way, we'd be having a completely different discussion. So, you know, there's no doubt about it. He's had no luck in important games this season. The game against Arsenal would have looked completely different. You easily could have made for that, a case for Garnacho being onside with different angles. Say he was or he wasn't, okay. The Hoyland penalty. You know, these games turn out completely differently. City get a penalty. They probably would have beaten it anyway, but they got a penalty at a key moment in the game, right? The Arsenal goal, you know, Declan Rice, where there's a foul on Johnny Evans right before that. You know, these are key moments. You know, there's been a lot of moments like this season where I can really only think of the Wolves game that it's actually went United's favour. You could argue that Mabry could have been sent off against Newcastle. I accept that. excuse me. But truthfully, it's quite ridiculous how many decisions that allegedly even themselves out over the course of a season go against United in the most unique way that you almost never see given anywhere else. Now, some people are talking about Ten Hag should be sacked and all that. I don't believe that. Eric Ten Hag was the only manager in England last season outside of Pep Guardiola to win a trophy. The season before he came, United were much like they were, you know, right now, a mess. And he, you know, the team that he had last season, I really enjoyed watching after the Brentford game. You know, definitely felt like United were making progress. But that team was built around a couple of key individuals. It was built around Lisandro Martinez, who made such a massive difference to United, not just defensively, because he shored up that defence, but in how they played out from the back. It was also built around an informed Casemiro and an informed Rashford. It's not Eric Ten Hag's fault that Marcus Rashford's going through this goal drought. I'm not at a point where I want to completely write Casemiro off, because I think that he's been playing in a team that's left him exposed because the midfield hasn't been balanced. And when you do that, the players will look leggy because the game passes them by. When Martinez didn't play, Luke Shaw played in that left centre-back position, and he was exceptional. He hasn't had Luke Shaw either, not at left-back, not as his backup centre-back. He hasn't had Wan-Bissaka. And yes, Wan-Bissaka started to tire last night towards the end of the game and made a couple of bad decisions, but in the second minute last night, United scored a goal down the right-hand side. Anthony's on the bench. Wan-Bissaka gets high, plays a lovely reverse pass in for Scott McTominay. Bang. Rasmus Højlund gets a ball he's been screaming for all season across the box. Goal. He is a much better player than Diogo Dalot defensively and probably offensively. Diogo Dalot is a below-average backup fullback. He was responsible for the first goal against Galatasaray, responsible for City's second goal because he jogs back, responsible for the goal against Newcastle because he mentally switches off. He mentally switches off again against Copenhagen. And what is a simple ball, right? I mean, sense danger, know who's behind you, clear the ball. So, you know, how many of those are actually his players? You know, I think he's had 12 different defensive lineups this season in 16 games. Trying to bet on a goalkeeper with no consistency in your back four. And, you know, Maguire's capable of good games against opposition like Sheffield United, Burnley, and stuff like that. But when you play top-level opposition like Man City, and United conceded three, you know, when they play top-level opposition, you know, that's where I have concerns, because I don't think he's the quickest. I think he gives United everything. But when you're trying to play high, I don't think Maguire can play in a team that plays a high line. Now, United were playing counter-attack, so he fits into that team. That's a team that Solskjaer bought him to play for. So he fits into a team that plays a low block, hits on the counter-attack. But Ten Hag has lost some really key players that last season's success was built on. I don't think you need to have a like-for-like replacement for Lisandro Martinez, where you can bring somebody in and the levels won't drop. I think the closest thing they had that was Luke Shaw. Obviously, Luke Shaw being out, I think, has also had an impact on Marcus Rashford's form. You might have some mitigation to say similar for Antony, although Antony has been atrocious. In my opinion, one of the biggest issues that Antony should answer for is the fact that he's not willing to fight for a guy who brought him there and who's under enormous scrutiny for bringing him there for the price tag that he did. Fine if you can't play well because your confidence is low, but you have to give 100%. If you look at the goal against Fulham, Palestri makes that happen, not out of talent, but just out of work ethic. He goes into a tackle, he refuses to give up on the ball, and he makes something happen. You know, I saw a moment, I think he covered this in the podcast with James, where Harry Wilson cut inside, cut across Antony, and honestly, the pathetic leg that he put out infuriated me. So, you know, I'm not saying Ten Hag doesn't deserve legitimate criticism for some of the things that he's done. I do think that, you know, he does. He hasn't been perfect. No manager is. But I think there are certain things that you need to take into consideration. There's none of the problems that exist at United that I can say are specifically Ten Hag's. If you look at every criticism that's been levelled at every United manager since Moyes, they're the same. Moyes, Van Gaal, Mourinho, Solskjaer, all about no shape, no style, they can't coach, you know, sack them, all this stuff. Same stuff, Ranić, all of it, right? And most of those guys, you know, Van Gaal won a trophy, Mourinho won a trophy, you know, they had fleeting moments of success that they could never build on. And a big part of that is because of the internal chaos. What you see on the pitch is a microcosm of what goes on off it. It's a leaderless football club that has almost nobody in an executive level incentivized for sport and success. You've got a bunch of people in key departments with one foot out the door that aren't working towards any long-term goal, that aren't really interested in that, that aren't putting the effort in because they don't believe they're going to be there much longer. And so you've essentially got a significant number of United employees on gardening leave. So there is no reporting structure above Ten Hag. There's no one you can go to with a personal problem. There's no one you can go to that turns around to these players and says, look, if Ten Hag's going to fail, he'll fail because of football reasons. It will not be because players are coming moaning above his head saying, we don't like him, we want him sacked. I mean, these are the players that said they didn't like Moyes because, you know, he didn't understand how big the club was. And then they said they didn't like Mourinho because he was too nasty, you know, too personal. Then they said they didn't like Solskjaer because he was too nice. And then they said they didn't like Ranić because he dug him out in press conferences. And now they're going to say they don't like Ten Hag. So what? You don't have to love your manager. But if you're using that as a reason for you not giving 100% or for you not willing to put everything on the line for your fans and your family and the club that employs you, you shouldn't be here. And United must get out of this cycle. This is familiar territory. And this is always the place where they sack the manager. Because the alternative is putting a football structure in place, having it properly funded, you know, going out of your way to have the best in class in these people, having a very clear identity, having a very clear vision, being patient and executing it, because this is sport and success is what defines success at the football club. So they don't have any of that. So when you're competing with Manchester City, everything inside Manchester City is geared towards sport and success. You heard Guardiola say this after the derby. Every resource they invest is towards sport and success. Every evaluation of an employee is towards sport and success. In other words, their primary objective is to get the best product on the field, the best product in the market. Manchester United's primary objective is to get a product on the market that sells, that they can maximize profit. They don't care about its quality. They don't care about, you know, its safety. They don't care about, you know, how the user, you know, how the consumer feels. And they don't care about any of that. They just want a product on the field that, you know, that allows them to get as much profit as possible. So if you said to them, look, let's improve the product, we'll cut our profit margins, but we'll improve the end product, Chris aren't interested in that. So Eric Ten Hag is playing a completely different game than what Pep Guardiola is. Working for two businesses that just happen to be in the same industry, but have completely different models, completely different ethoses. And so comparing like for like, you know, They aren't like for like. These are completely different businesses. Manchester United just won a team that can finish in the top four. They're not trying to win the league. They haven't been trying to win the league for a decade. If you look at the team that played against City, how many of those players would get in the top four team? How many? An on-formed Rashford, Bruno, and probably that's about it. You know, what does that tell you? I mean, truthfully, if you look at United, Manchester United's best 11 is a top four team. Outside of that, there might be a top eight team. If you go outside of United's first team, best first 11, you're talking about average Premier League players, and in some cases, below average Premier League players. So that's what you should expect once United have three or four injuries, is an average Premier League team, because that's pretty much what they are. So I understand that United's history demands, United's present has certain levels of success. If you look at United's history, with the exception of two managers, Matt Busby and Ferguson, it's been more or less this: mediocrity. You know, occasional trophy here, occasional trophy there. People like me are lucky to have lived through the era of unbridled success with Ferguson. And obviously those were extremely lucky also to experience some Matt Busby. But for United to be on a level with Manchester City or Liverpool, two football clubs that cannot be commercially successful without being successful on the pitch, they have to have the same stated goal. And they don't. So until that changes, all you're really going to get is some fluctuation. Bit of improvement, drop off. Bit of improvement, drop off. Because it's not sustainable, because it's not intended to be built upon. And the culture at any business is set by the owners. It's a reflection of their personality and their priorities, because that's how they incentivize their employees to have alignment with their priorities. So you can't blame the people inside United for doing the job that the Glazers are telling them to do. But for those that are at United for sport and success, they become disillusioned quickly, because they quickly work out that that's not really the club's goal. And so every organism has a relationship with its environment. Okay, that is what eventually an organism will do. It will adapt to the environment, and it will resemble the environmental conditions. I'm not exculpating United players. They do deserve criticism for certain things. You know, you look at what's going on in the world right now, and I get articles that Manchester United players are complaining their socks are too tight. I mean, they have to realise how utterly ridiculous this is. However, like I said, we're not asking them to compete for the league. We're asking them to compete for 90 minutes. We should be entitled to that. But overall, the constant disillusionment and listlessness that you see in players can't always be down to a manager. At some point, we have to say, these problems transcend a manager. We've tried to fix this problem by sacking a manager four or five times, and it hasn't worked once. Maybe to really address this root cause, we need to look beyond the manager and say, before we get to the manager, let's look at other things. Because if we're going to just keep sacking the driver and getting a new driver in and saying, here's this car, it's got new tires, got new paint job and an oil change, now go in the Daytona 500, and they don't. At some point, you got to look at the car. At some point, you got to look at the tools they're being given and saying, are they giving this individual the ability to win this race? For United to catch City, they have to outpace them for a couple of years. If you run a race and someone's ahead of you, you have to outpace them to catch them. United can't even keep pace with them. So I understand United's history demands they are of a certain level. But we need to look at the reality. You need to see Chelsea. Chelsea, a football club that has spent over $1 billion with no clear sporting objective. No alignment, no unity, no agreement. No departments that function together that are a conduit for the football club, that give you something that has a very clear, defined goal. You integrate all these departments so that they all support each other, and it's all geared towards getting the best team and best product on the field. So it doesn't matter how many amazing professional athletes you buy. The structure behind them and how you motivate human beings and your commitment to the same goals is what will determine whether they achieve them or not. What are the accountability, what is the structure in place for players who, you know, if you look at João Cancelo, crosses Guardiola once, Manchester City in complete agreement, he's gone. No matter what the financial cost is to Manchester City, it's worth paying, because keeping him will undermine our manager and it will give an impression to other players that they too can get away with this. And once you create a precedent of tolerating it here, you have to tolerate it everywhere. And this is where I respect Ten Hag, where he's saying there are no exceptions. Cristiano Ronaldo, Marcus Rashford, doesn't matter. If you do not conform to disciplinary measures, then we are going to have consequences. He dropped Rashford before the Wolves game when he badly needed him last season, when he was flat. Took enormous courage to do that. He was right about Cristiano Ronaldo. Rafael Varane. Has Rafael Varane put a performance in this season where you thought, you know what, he's got every right to be upset being left out? No. I can't think of one. I mean, he was atrocious in that Galatasaray game. He was poor last night. So, for me, with Ten Hag, I can't look at... I mean, maybe he could have handled the Jadon Sancho thing a bit differently. You know, it's a couple of days after the transfer window. Maybe he should have turned around and said, you know, Jadon's injured. Whatever. And dig him out later. But you know... Considering you just had the Antony situation happen, you're short on the right. Probably not the best thing to do, in my opinion. But there's no doubt about it, who's right in the situation. Jadon Sancho was not right. Jadon Sancho can't show up to training on time, which is a repeated problem. He was dropped for the Spurs game for the same reason. Then Ten Hag is right. Arteta had to do this with Aubameyang. Was showing up late. The team meetings and stuff. Said you're out. It has paid dividends for him. Lacazette got rid of all those players that thought Arsenal are a club that aren't serious. We just have to finish top four. So we can get away with the discipline and everything else. And once Arteta held the line, the club backed them on that. Then you're able to create an environment that says the athletes... The only way you can survive here is performing at your peak. If you want to do this, 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 you will not survive in exactly the same way you would not survive at Real Madrid or any other top club. And players have a very, very clear delineated line between what's acceptable and what's going to get you kicked out. And the problem is at United, that line's always been blurred. because of your commercial value and all the other things, because United don't evaluate their players based on how they perform. They evaluate their players based on what the commercial value is, how much it would cost to replace them, how much it costs to keep them, all those things. That's what a business does. Football clubs don't work like that. Not football clubs that prioritise success over everything else. So for Ten Hag, it's not an easy situation. He does have to does deserve some questions over Mason Mount. And I've wondered if Mason Mount was a priority for United and the main target because Chelsea were going to be flexible on the payments. You know, Mason Mount was a relatively easy deal for United to do because Chelsea had to sell for FFP, and because obviously they're flush with cash, we're willing to be extremely flexible on payments. How many other midfielders could Ten Hag have signed needing the club to be that flexible on payments? Not many. Now, I'm not saying Ten Hag doesn't like him. Of course he does. He liked him at Vitesse when he was there. So he takes responsibility for that, in my opinion. And when you're not playing Mason Mount in your biggest games of the season, I'm asking why. You know, if you look at Ten Hag's midfield, how different does it need to look to fit Mason Mount in there? You can't say, well, if Casemiro's not there, Mason Mount's not playing. So to me, and it's weird because he answered the question about Varane being left out was tactical, which Rafael Varane was not happy about. I haven't seen, and maybe I've missed it, an answer as to why he's not starting Mason Mount. He deserves some question marks of that. But I most certainly would not be in a position where I would consider sacking him, you know, because I don't think that would solve anything. And I'm not even sure you'd get a new manager bounce, because when you look at those players, so many of them just look completely fed up. They're mentally fatigued. They're psychologically traumatized. You can see the nervousness that creeps into their game towards the end of games. Even the games that they've won, they've come very close to throwing away in the last minute. And you can just see there's no trust in themselves. There's no trust in their composure. There's no trust that they have the quality to see games out. Even when they score a goal, they can see quickly. All these things, you know, that show that the fragility of United, and I used to say this about Arsenal, you know, that they were so mentally weak, they could be bullied really easy. Well, United are exactly where Arsenal were at that time. You know, a club that defined success by finishing top four. We're always relatively easy to beat by the big teams. They never had an aura of confidence about them. He never had an aura that frightened teams. They were a big football club, but what was on the pitch was always, you know, relatively easy to beat. I remember the Stepanovs and, you know, a lot of the Arsenal players that I felt were nowhere near good enough. But Wenger had to bring him in because he didn't have the money to compete. You know, what their last league title was in 2004. Abramovich bought Chelsea about 2003. So once that Chelsea money came in, Arsenal could no longer compete. So United are in that situation right now. So I wouldn't blame Ten Hag, just like it wasn't Arsene Wenger's fault for the situation Arsenal found themselves in. He's an exceptional manager. I think internally a lot of things have to be fixed. I would like to see United go after young Rooney Badarji, if I'm saying that correctly. Looks an exceptional talent, 17. You know, took his goal really, really well. Copenhagen's top goal scorer, the type of player United in the past would have been all over. Type of player in the present, they're far too incompetent to actually go after a player like that. 2-3 years from now, after he's been at Dortmund for 3 years, you know, and had exceptional years, you know, they'll probably try to go in for him at 120 million and blow their whole summer budget on him. Instead of doing what's obvious now and going after these players, Copenhagen, you could get him out of there, I'm sure, at a decent price. A price that really should be within United's price range, given the fact that they need a player on the right as we speak. Especially Jadon Sancho goes in January. I would love to see United go after someone like that. I know FFP and all this, but he's a player that I would love to see at Manchester United right up the football clubs, Ali in terms of profile and everything else. Well, we will see what happens. You know, it'd have to beat Luton at the weekend. I'm not certain that they will. They were good against Liverpool last week. And one thing about United that I've seen this season is they're capable of lowering their game to the level of the opposition. They're just not capable of raising it. First 40 minutes, like I said, was encouraging last night, but United need to be able to have the discipline when they go 2-0 down, when they go down to 10 men at 2-0 to be able to see a game out. They should be able to do that. So we'll see what actually happens at the weekend, but it's a game that they have to win. And if you can't beat the top teams or anyone in the top nine, you have to win these games. I fear if United were to lose a game against Luton, I think that the criticism that would come Ten Hag's way would be a cacophony. It would be very, very difficult. I don't want to see him sacked. I don't think United can afford to sack him. And I don't even think the people in the football club at this moment in time have the ability to sack him. Because from what we understand, you know, any of us would expect that to be their decision. Something needs to be announced on that really, really soon, because you have so many employees in limbo internally and that can't continue. And so something like that needs to be announced imminently. The football club needs clarity. The players, the fans, everybody's just been dragged on way, way, way too long. From what, you know, I can gather, they're expecting to announce something on that within a week or so. I need to get that firmed up, but that's what I've been told, and they haven't verified that, so I would need to verify it. But I do know that they had a number of meetings, and that strategic meetings about how the sporting department would work. My assumption is they wouldn't be doing that unless there was a broad agreement on the main stuff. There's a reason why they weren't talking about this 4 or 5 months ago. So I would imagine they have broad agreement on all major issues, in terms of buyouts and in terms of what they're paying and investment and all that. So the sooner the better. Anyway, thanks for listening to my rambling, my podcast by myself. I don't know how I'm willing to talk for 54 minutes, 52 minutes. By myself, but nonetheless, I hope it was interesting. Thanks to all of you for downloading the podcast. I hope you're all well, and be back on Monday. Take it easy, folks.